Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, the opinion column in Scientific American, headlined "The Caveman and the Bomb," conveys, just a little more colorfully, the sense one got from the Senate hearing on the process involved in the use of a nuclear weapon. Put simply, folks are scared that Donald Trump may not understand the difference between threats to rain fire and fury on the people of North Korea and the devastating reality of nuclear war. But while we're talking about the dangers of Trump having his hand on the figurative button, we should also be asking why we maintain a world-ending arsenal at all. We'll hear from William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, about what drives nuclear weapons production. Also on the show, countries from around the world are grappling with the current and coming impacts of climate disruption at the UN conference in Bonn, Germany. The Trump administration, for its part, contributed what was described as a surreal event promoting fossil fuels. We'll talk about the disconnect between the White House and the rest of the planet on climate change with Karen Orenstein, Deputy Director of Economic Policy at Friends of the Earth. That's all coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at recent press. You could say the New York Times is very interested in the squashing of free speech on college campuses. But as research by FAIR analyst Adam Johnson shows, that wouldn't quite describe it. Over the past 18 months, the New York Times has dedicated 21 columns and articles to the subject of conservatives' free speech on campus, while just three talked about the silencing of college liberals or leftists. Johnson reviewed Times articles, columns, and op-eds and found a clear emphasis on documenting and condemning the perceived suppression of right-wing voices at American universities, but vanishingly little mention of harassment campaigns against leftist professors and/or the criminalization of leftist causes, such as the pro-Palestinian BDS, or Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. Since May 1, 2016, the Times has run pieces like "College Republicans, Once the Best Party on Campus, Endure Taunts Over Trump," "My liberal university cemented my vote for Trump," "On campus, Trump fans say they need safe spaces," "The isolation of college libertarians," "Life and combat for Republicans at Berkeley," and "These campus inquisitions must stop." While the paper did sporadically report the dozens of laws throughout the country that seek to criminalize BDS, they didn't put that in the context of college free speech. Professors silenced or fired over activities critical of Israel, like Berkeley's Paul Hadway or SUNY Plattsburgh's Simona Sharoni, weren't covered, much less defended, in the Times, leaving much more room for pearl-clutching over the lack of far-right professors or the mean things said about Trump supporters by undergrads. Besides the odd notion that college campuses should be one-to-one hospitable to all ideologies at all times, the idea that certain viewpoints, like supply-side economics, racial eugenics, or a Eurocentric view of history, are underrepresented on campus because they aren't intellectually credible is never entertained. So Johnson concludes on the dubious altar of ideological diversity, the paper of record sacrifices any sense of proportionality. With alt-right and neo-Nazi elements on the march and a White House that's, at the very least, sympathetic to them, the Times focuses its tremendous influence time and again on creating a space in academia for reactionary, racist, and sexist views that are overrepresented in almost every other sector of society. And finally, one of the most important and also kindest media critics has passed away. Edward Herman was the main author of Manufacturing Consent, The Political Economy of the Mass Media, written with Noam Chomsky, a 1980s masterwork that exposed how elite U.S. media typically function as propaganda organs for U.S. empire and militarism. FAIR founder Jeff Cohen recalled how, as part of a lawyer's delegation monitoring an election in Death Squad-run El Salvador in 1984, he and a group of progressive attorneys at the Salvador Sheraton scrambled to get their hands on a shipment of hot-off-the-press copies of Demonstration Elections, Ed's devastating book with Frank Broadhead about the U.S. staging elections as PR shows to prop up repressive regimes, from the Dominican Republic to Vietnam to Salvador. Ed wrote or co-wrote classic works of political and media criticism, including The Political Economy of Human Rights, The Real Terror Network, Beyond Hypocrisy, Decoding the News in an Age of Propaganda, and The Global Media. A longtime friend and supporter of FAIR, he occasionally wrote for our magazine Extra on, for example, double standards in coverage of Suharto and Pol Pot. Jeff Cohen notes that Ed's name often went unmentioned in discussion of manufacturing consent, for example, in the Hollywood movie Good Will Hunting. Asked if that troubled him, Ed answered, "Not at all. The point is, the movie could bring the book more readers." That was Ed. He will be missed. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. We have this idea that things should make sense, but we have homeless people and empty buildings. We have unemployed people and work that needs doing. And we have enough nuclear weapons to destroy the planet and are building more. The thing is, these things do make sense, just not in a way we would hope for or the way we are often told. When it comes to nuclear weapons, our next guest explains all the talk you hear about strategic considerations driving proliferation, how do we look tough with North Korea and so on, is in a sense a distraction from what's really going on. If you really want to know why the U.S. keeps churning out nuclear warheads, follow the money. William Hartung has been doing just that for years now. He's director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, author most recently of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, and a contributor to the book Sleepwalking to Armageddon, The Threat of Nuclear Annihilation, which is just out now from New Press. He joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome back to Counterspin, William Hartung.
Thanks so much for having me.
The Senate Foreign Relations Committee held a hearing on the authority and process for the use of nuclear weapons. One senator said constituents are asking him at town halls if Trump can just order a nuclear attack without any controls, and obviously that's because they're worried that he might. As you write, a tough guy attitude on nuclear weapons, when combined with an apparent ignorance about their world-ending potential, adds up to a toxic brew. No argument there. Let's start by just talking about the current state of the arsenal that we're being told needs to be modernized and expanded. We have what, some 4,000 nuclear weapons?
Yes, in the active stockpile. So any of those could be deployed at any time. There's a little under 2,000 ready to go now on ballistic missiles and in submarines, on bombers, and that's far more than would be needed to destroy North Korea. That would be a handful of weapons, pretty much disable and destroy any country in the world. And if there were a large exchange, probably end the prospects of life on the planet over the medium term. So there's massive nuclear overkill. And, you know, some experts, those who believe in nuclear deterrence as opposed to getting rid of nuclear weapons, say about 300 would be enough to dissuade any country from attacking the United States with nuclear weapons. So you've got huge excess. Some of it is, you know, leftover ideology from the Cold War, but as I said, most of it is power and profits.
Well, let's get into that, because despite the arsenal you've just described, we are looking at a modernization plan to the tune of some $1.7 trillion. I'll ask it simply, why is that the case?
Well, I think the nuclear enterprise is on autopilot. They always build a new generation. The companies always need a new contract. The Pentagon cooked this up under Obama, so it's not, unlike many other things, a Trump invention. But General Dynamics wants to make new nuclear submarines. Companies like Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin want to make new nuclear bombers. The Ballistic Missile Force, which is based in Wyoming, North Dakota, some in Nebraska, et cetera. The senators from those states are very keen on a new generation of ballistic missiles because they're afraid they might get dropped from the arsenal if they're not brand new and shiny. So there's a lot of pork barrel politics involved, and also just kind of bureaucracies want to be fed, and they want to be fed dollars, both in the Pentagon and the services and, of course, the companies.
I think it was from you that I learned about the strategy, if you will, of breaking up the production process of a particular weapon so that you'll have many states and their representatives invested in it.
Exactly. And the nuclear complex is very much that way. You've got weapons labs in California, New Mexico. You've got a uranium facility in Tennessee. You've got submarines based in Washington State and Georgia. You've got those ballistic missiles in the northern Midwest, as I mentioned. Connecticut's building nuclear-capable submarines, and on and on. So if you put together the senators and representatives from those states as kind of a solid block, I'll support your nuke if you support mine. You've already got a huge group in Congress pushing for this stuff. And, you know, when Chuck Hagel, for example, was being confirmed as Secretary of Defense, he had signed on as an advisor to a project by the group Global Zero that said we could get by with as few as 900 nuclear weapons, not the 4,000, and also perhaps we didn't need ballistic missiles. And he was pilloried by members from states that have the missiles or the command and control for the missiles and so forth, to the point where he basically backed off and said, well, that was just one idea. You know, that was a study. That doesn't mean it's something we're going to do. So Congress is a big part of the problem.
Well, I'd like to do a little bit of history, as you do in this piece for Tom Dispatch, because it seems as though we used to see this in a more clear-eyed way. I mean, Eisenhower pretty much called it, right, with the military-industrial complex.
Yes, and he was most concerned about things like the push for a new nuclear bomber by the contractors in the Air Force. Some generals who, you know, he was the commander-in-chief after all, were talking out of school about needing this, even though he thought we didn't. He basically called the push for the bomber and the false claims about a missile gap that were used to fuel a missile buildup political demagoguery. And he said that basically there was undue influence on senators like John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, by the industry to get them to adopt these positions. So he was right on target way back then, and I think he would be horrified to see the shape of the nuclear industrial complex now, the size of the companies like Lockheed Martin, which gets $30 to $40 billion a year, you know, in a good year for them, not a good year for the taxpayers. So there were no companies of that size in Eisenhower's day, and they have that much more influence because of their spread across the country, their campaign contributions, their lobbyists, and so forth.
Well, I was just going to go there because the mechanics, the techniques, you say, haven't really changed fundamentally, and that is campaign contributions and lobbying. And it's not partisan. It's bipartisan.
Exactly. So, for example, the entire weapons industry has, in any given year, 700 to 1,000 registered lobbyists, almost two for every member of Congress in some years. And that's not counting, you know, board members and people who consult and other people who try to influence the process but aren't, you know, technically lobbyists. They give tens of millions of dollars in contributions. They also fund think tanks like the Center for Security Policy, the Lexington Institute, the Democratic-leaning Center for New American Security. In many cases, those think tanks advocate positions that the logical conclusion is we need more Pentagon spending. So they're almost like, in some cases, mouthpieces for the industry, but very useful because the industry doesn't have to lobby for it themselves. It's being done under the kind of alleged aura of objectivity, which, of course, doesn't exist when you're on the payroll of the arms industry.
Well, and media, of course, play a role here in a general failure to indicate, you know, which think tanks are tied to where, so that they do kind of abet this process of presenting them as independent entities that just happen to have a point of view that dovetails with that of weapons makers.
Yeah, we need truth in labeling, basically.
Yes, exactly. Well, and another thing that media can play a role in is credulous, shall we say, reporting of another angle of approach, which is that weapons are about jobs.
Yes, well, the thing is, Pentagon spending is the least effective way to create jobs. Economists at the University of Massachusetts have done very good work on this, and they've figured out infrastructure spending is about 1.5 times as many jobs as Pentagon spending, and education spending more than twice as many. So it's really about serving particular areas and members. You know, if you have a fighter plane built in St. Louis, the Missouri delegation is going to push for that. If you have nuclear capable submarine in Connecticut, the delegation is going to push for it. And those, as you said, are both Democrats and Republicans. So it's not that we couldn't create jobs differently. It's that there's a political logjam in Washington against investing in other things.
Well, let me just ask you finally, you remind us that grassroots activism in Europe and in the U.S., the Freeze movement, that was what played a role in helping turn around Ronald Reagan's view on nuclear weapons. Is that what we need now?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, globally, there's been some hope. I mean, the UN has passed a treaty to abolish nuclear weapons, which many people thought would not be possible. And the majority of the world's countries are behind that. Of course, the big players are not. But I think this puts them on the moral defensive and the political defensive such that if we can build the movement here, we might make some progress. And of course, all bets are off about what Donald Trump himself might do. But I think there's already building support in Congress for a new policy, including not letting the president be the sole person to decide if we launch a nuclear war.
We've been speaking with William Hartung. His article, Massive Overkill, brought to you by the Nuclear Industrial Complex, can be found on tomdispatch.com. And the new book, Sleepwalking to Armageddon, The Threat of Nuclear Annihilation, is out from New Press. William Hartung, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A New York Times explainer in advance of the Bonn climate talks told readers the worst-case scenario for the UN summit is it, quote, could get bogged down by the traditional rifts between richer and poorer nations, close quote. That might, quote, stall momentum right before the next big round of climate talks in 2018, close quote. Of course, others may see different forces behind any stalled momentum and might offer a different frame for questions of climate justice than that of a traditional rift between the world's rich and poor. Karen Orenstein is the deputy director of the Economic Policy Program at Friends of the Earth U.S., where she works on issues of international public finance and climate finance in particular. She joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Karen Orenstein.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, I have to start with the event that inspired a statement from you and that boggled so many. Here we're at an international conference to address the reality of human-driven climate disruption. It's in Germany, but it's hosted by Fiji in part to highlight the problems facing island nations, problems caused by other countries' emissions. And the Trump administration does a presentation titled The Role of Cleaner and More Efficient Fossil Fuels and Nuclear Power in Climate Mitigation. What the heck?
I think you introduced it correctly by talking about this was in response to, you know, the reality of climate change. But Trump and his administration live in a parallel universe that is not based in reality. So it is not a surprise that, you know, they're climate deniers. For them, upside is down and downside is up, so that they would go to a climate conference, the most important climate talks of the year, to try to promote climate pollution. It's just what they do.
It's truly strange, you know. But Barry Worthington, the executive director of the United States Energy Association, who spoke at this panel, he told the New York Times beforehand, he's just going to be delivering a dose of reality. You know, he says no credible projection shows fossil fuels meeting less than 40% of global energy. He just says it's going to be a horrible experience for him to have to deliver that message to climate activists. But, quote, the reality of it is the world is going to continue to use fossil fuels. And if I can throw myself on the hand grenade to help people realize that, I'm willing to do it, close quote. So their argument is they're just being realistic.
Isn't he nice to make such sacrifices? I think again, it comes down to the question of reality. His reality as a fossil fuel executive is one thing. The reality of, say, for example, someone living in Bangladesh whose home is now, you know, getting inundated with water, or in Kiribati or Tuvalu or Marshall Islands or Fiji, which is hosting the conference, for them, their reality is that their country faces an existential crisis because it might not exist anymore, or farmers in Malawi whose crops aren't working, or people in Houston or Florida or Puerto Rico who just encountered storms that have like unprecedented vigor to them and resulted in unprecedented destruction. That's their reality. So I would believe more the farmer in Bangladesh than I would believe the coal and oil executive like Barry Worthington.
Well, I want to bring you back to this question of climate finance. What does that mean? What questions are being addressed by that?
Well, basically, that's about the provision of money from rich countries to poor countries to help the poorer countries, you know, adapt to the unavoidable impacts of climate change and to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Because to do that is, A, very expensive, and B, they're not the ones responsible for causing the climate crisis, right? The U.S., more than any other country in the history of the world, is most responsible for causing the climate crisis. So we abide by the idea of the polluter pays principle, the idea that if you walk into a shop and you break something, you're in charge of paying for it. Well, we sort of broke the climate. We're responsible for paying for it, the U.S. and other rich countries. And so that's really what climate finance is about. It's both about justice, it's about practicality, it's about expense, and it's about morality.
So what it sounds like it's not about is an age-old traditional rift, you know, that will always be with us between the world's rich and the world's poor. You make it much more dynamic than that.
Yeah, I really dislike that framing. The rift is caused because wealthy countries have damaged the climate in incredible ways, and it's having the first and worst impact on countries, for example, in Africa. And so it's about people in Africa saying, we need to be able to live. We deserve a life of dignity. The actions of people in richer countries have impinged on their ability to have sort of a dignified life. I don't know. I wouldn't call that a rift. I would call that about fairness and justice and basically the right to livelihoods and to a quality life. It's not a rift. A rift makes it sound like there's, like, you know, people disagreeing over whether, you know, bananas are the best fruit, you know, and it's not. This is people's lives.
Well, this event that we're talking about, this fossil fuel described as surreal event at the climate talks, it was interrupted. I want to be clear, you know, before it even started, two U.S. governors from Washington and Oregon came in and said, you know, this is not, we don't agree with this. This is not our view. And then young activists who were there interrupted with a 7-minute song, you know, and then left peacefully. At the same time, we saw the largest ever climate protest in Germany. I feel that people understand that what we're talking about is a matter of political will and not some sort of arcane science question or technology question. It seems that activism really is going to be the core to moving forward here.
Yeah, I agree. There's not rocket science here. It is entirely political. The fact that, you know, 95% plus of, you know, scientists agree that humans are causing climate change is causing global warming, et cetera, it's a fact. It's about entrenched interests in wealthier countries, you know, the fossil fuel industry, for example, Wall Street. They want to maintain the status quo to their benefit. And I think we often see governments not necessarily acting in the best interest of their constituencies. That's certainly true of the Trump administration. So to necessarily expect that governments with their own vested economic interests are going to, you know, necessarily do what is needed for the benefit of, you know, the average ordinary people and the planet is probably not entirely in line with sort of the history of civilization, which is to say that I think we're going to find the answers in the streets. The demand will come from the streets and from just everyday folks who take action, especially now people are so inspired to act because I mean, Trump is just such an extreme villain in so many ways, including on the climate.
Well, I have to note in this context a new study from Public Citizen that showed that media severely underreport activism at climate conferences, even though those demonstrations are really a primary way that the public is claiming a voice here. And that underreporting distorts public understanding. It gives the impression that there's less support for this action than there actually is. I wonder what, in general, you might like to see from media more of or less of more broadly on not just climate talks, but on this whole set of issues. What do you think journalism can do here?
Yeah, I agree. There's a big problem with corporate control of media, and also this idea that they're afraid to wade into the controversy of climate change, which isn't actually a controversy. So I would, for example, like to see during weather reports, meteorologists talk about climate change because that affects the weather in an extreme way. So that actually, you know, your daily, nightly newscast, which a lot of people watch when they, you know, when they have the Doppler radar and all that stuff, they can talk about climate change. Yeah, certainly to be honest with you, most of my own news comes from Democracy Now! And alternative sources. And until I think we have less media consolidation and more local, decentralized media, it's going to be up to people on the ground to get their stories out and to pay attention to alternative sources of information. But, I mean, I think things are changing. I'm from Illinois. I go back home, talk to my family, and they think about climate change in a way that they didn't before, and they're not a bunch of very political people. Mm-hmm. So I think things are changing, especially with the devastation that's happened in the United States, and especially with just how extreme Trump is.
So maybe not thanks to media or thanks to government, but things are nevertheless changing in terms of awareness.
Yeah, maybe in spite of media and the government.
All right, then. I'll have to end it there. We've been speaking with Karen Orenstein of Friends of the Earth U.S. You can find their work online at foe.org. Karen Orenstein, thank you so much for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find the interviews and transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.